292 is, again, a, it's the, it's a continuation of some other technical mitzvahs. There's the mitzvah that when a non-Jew, you know, a non-Jew could bring a korban in the basement, because the Gemara says that the Gentiles, the goyim don't even know what they lost by destroying the Beis HaMikdash, right? Because there were benefits in the Beis HaMikdash for them also, right? Mitzvah 292 is a prohibition that when a Gentile brings an animal which has some type of physical imperfection, you're not allowed to accept it from him and use it as a korban. Okay, the, as a matter of fact, the non-Jews themselves, there are halachas, if you look in the Gemara, in the Masechta Avodah Zarah, when in Noahide law, if you buy an animal from a goy, right, there's always a fear of certain animals or selling an animal to a goy, right? If a goy comes to a Jew, nowadays it doesn't apply as much, if a goy would come to a Jew in the time of the Gemara, he would say to him, "I'd like to buy a white hen." The halacha is, you're not allowed to sell him a white hen. Why? Couldn't sell a goy a white hen. Why not?
They need to be saved.
What?
They need to be saved.
Save the white hen?
No, save, so then, save, we sell the Jews for, it's so few of them that they need to take them to the...
That's an interesting idea.
Sell it with a blush.
Just a guess.
It has to do with, what do you think, what would you do with that?
Too good for the goy, maybe.
Too good for the goy, no. It has to do with the fact that they, that there's a very good chance that they're gonna take the animal, they're gonna take the chicken, and they're going to use it as a sacrifice for their idol worship. Right, they're going to use the animal in their sacrificial service. Therefore, you're not allowed to sell them an animal that he specifically designates. If he's asking, "I want a white hen," why does he want a white one for? Obviously, white was one of the things that they used for sacrifices. Now, what if it's a white hen that's missing a foot? Right, so there, the Gemara says you could sell it then, because even among the nine, even among the idol worshippers, they had a code based on Noahide law, which then was perverted by them. It was distorted, eventually channeled into idol worship. But they had a code among themselves of what they are allowed to use as a sacrifice, what you're not. Now, this is a continuation of a previous mitzvah. The previous mitzvahs, that one of the mitzvahs is that even a Jew is not allowed to bring an animal that's blemished to the Beis HaMikdash, right? Now, you're not allowed, a non-Jew is also not allowed to bring a blemished animal. One example of an animal that's blemished is a cow that has a certain red streak in its eye. Something so minimal, right? Like a red streak in the eye is one of the things that disqualifies the animal from being used in the Beis HaMikdash. So the destruction of the temple, if you remember the destruction of the temple, there was a Jew who was upset at the other Jews. And he went to the Roman Emperor, and the Roman Emperor, he said, he came to tell the Roman Emperor that the Jews are rebelling against you. And the Emperor said, "What's the proof?" And the Jew said, "If you send them a sacrifice to the temple, they will not bring the sacrifice. They will not offer the sacrifice that you send. But the Jews are going to rebel against you." So the Emperor said, "Okay, let's test it." And he sent them a cow to bring to the Beis HaMikdash. On the way to the Beis HaMikdash, the Jew took a knife, and apparently he made a slash in the cow's eye. A very slight cut, right? Didn't blind the cow, just a slight cut on the side of the eye, which according to halacha renders it not fit for service in the Beis HaMikdash, right? And when they brought the cow to the Beis HaMikdash, the Jews had a whole debate. They decided, we obviously cannot sacrifice this cow. And when the Roman Emperor, when the Romans heard about it, then they came in and they attacked. Right? That's what the Gemara in Gittin says, right? That was one of the causes. So the blemishes of the animal, the imperfections, are something that are flaws for a Jew and for a non-Jew. The non-Jew brings an animal to the Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to accept it from it. Under normal circumstances, if a goy comes to the Beis HaMikdash, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, if a goy would come to Yerushalayim with a sacrifice, you would accept it from him, you would sacrifice it. Right? There was nothing, that's why I keep repeating, and it's not, and not any, I don't mean it in a joke in any way. There was nothing against the goyim, per se, right? As long as they were not worshipping idols and influencing the Jews to worship idols. So one of the reasons why the command to wipe out the seven nations in the land of Canaan. What was the idea of wiping out the nations in the land of Canaan? The idea was that they were the root of idol worship in this world. You know what the word Canaan means, by the way? Eretz Canaan. You know what the word Canaan means? It comes from the Hebrew word.
It's on the board. Here,
I got one. There's the Hebrew word. Hach. No. The Hebrew word hach. No. That handwriting is good. Look at it. She reads it. That Hebrew word is hach. No. In the word hach. No, you see the root Canaan. Cannot, here's the word cannot. No, it's hachno'o, but in the root is kanea. Hachno'o, kinaan, is the root from the root of hachno'o. Hachno'o means to subjugate yourself. Right? God brought the Jewish people into the land of Canaan, because every land has a special quality to it, right? Which exerts an influence on the people. I'm sure you felt it when you get to Israel. Right? You feel there's something. The Gemara says the hair of Eretz Yisrael makes somebody wiser. You know that? The Gemara says there's no Torah like the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. Avira de Eretz Yisrael machkin. The air of Eretz Yisrael makes a person wiser. Right? There's a certain spiritual quality. If you go to San Francisco, or if you go to New York, right? The minute you go to New York, you get smart real quick. Right? You go to New York, the air of New York makes you wise. Right? You quickly put your hand on your wallet, right? Everybody, it doesn't take long to learn that, right? The air of New York makes you wise. Every land has a special quality, special characteristic to it. So, in both physically, I just like, guys, how many of you came to Israel the first week you were here, you got sick? Right, or first 2 weeks you were here, got sick. Right, if you came from far away, came from Scotland.
Came from India, so
many people. I don't know. Did you get sick? I know the first time I came to Israel, a lot of people do. People think it's the water. I personally don't think it's the water. I think it has to do with any time there's an environmental change. The Gemara even says it. The Gemara says that an environmental change, what the Gemara you called the word bodek. Literally, bodek means checks. Right. The Gemara, in the context of the Gemara, environmental change. It takes a toll on you, right? It takes its toll, an environmental change. You come to the land of Israel, it takes a toll. There's some type of physiological change. There's also a spiritual change. The land of Eretz Israel, why did the Jews have to go into Eretz Canaan? Why didn't they go into Uganda? Why didn't they? Because the land of Canaan, who was Canaan? Who was Canaan, if you think historically? Canaan was the son of Ham. You remember then the story with Noah, when Noah was lying exposed, and then his sons covered him. Now the one son, Ham, according to the Gemara, had done one of two things. He either committed the homosexual act on Noah, or according to the other opinion of the Gemara, he castrated him. Right? One of two opinions, what he was doing. Right? Now according to the opinion that he castrated him, it was trying to demonstrate, how many children did Noah have?
Three.
He had three children. Canaan and Ham felt, since there are three children, if the father has another child, then they're going to inherit the world from Noah, right? At the time, it was just them and Noah. They got out of the Teva, right? Kind of reminds you, what's that guy's name? The Far Side. I went to a Far Side cartoon where it's the day after the major nuclear Armageddon, right? And they have a picture of like this crater surface, like the moon, which is all dark and bleak. And he got a guy crawling, he's sticking his head out of the thing, looking around, right? And he looks like his, hey, first of all, we made it! Right, you know, and there's just him and her and the moon and nothing left, right? So when they got out of the table, that's what you had. You had the father and three sons. When Noah was going to die, who was going to inherit the earth? It was going to be divided up among the three of them. Ham didn't want that there should be another member to be divided up. So he castrated Noah, according to the Gemara, he castrated Noah to prevent Noah from having another son. Now, that means that the potential fourth son of Noah is the one that he didn't allow to be created. He didn't allow to be brought into the world. Noah cursed him. When Noah woke up, Noah came out of his wine, he was drunk, he came down from his high on the wine, and then it says that he cursed him. What was the curse? He cursed Ham. He cursed Canaan, who was the fourth son of Ham. Why did he curse? Why did he pick Canaan? Because Mita Kenegan Mita. Quid pro quo. You didn't allow me to have a fourth son. I'm going to curse your fourth son. What was the curse to Canaan? That he is going to be a slave to his brothers, right? And that's the man Canaan. And it's inherent in the word Canaan. Right, all of their names are in here. All the name is always the essence. Right, Shame was one of the sons. Right, Shame. What does Shame mean? The name. Who are the Semites? They're the people that are oriented towards God, towards the name. Yephes means what? Beauty. Yepheth, beauty, culture. Right, that's the Greek. That's the Europeans. Right, that's culture. Ham, who's Ham? Right, the Africans are Ham. Right, You go to Africa, what's the weather like, right? There aren't many winter coats being sold in Africa. It's hot, it's hot. Meaning that not only the society is hot, the entire culture is there's a certain spontaneity, hot-bloodedness in the culture, right? Ham has a son, Kenan. Kenan is the fourth son, Noah curses him, that he will be subjugated by his brothers, right? He will be nichna. He will there's a word in English. So you subjugate yourself. You accept their authority. Right? Is there a word for accepting authority?
Yeah.
Subservient. Perfect. That's the word. He will be subservient to his brothers. Eretz Canaan, the land of Canaan, means it's the land that breeds subservience. Right. Well, the Jewish people come out of Egypt, right, and they're brought into the land of Canaan because the land of Canaan is exactly what they need. They need their subservience. Their subservience is going to be to who? That's going to be channeled towards God. Okay. So the battle against the seven nations that are occupying the land of Canaan is not because they're going and let's kill them. To the contrary, the battle is because they are idol worshippers and they're mischanneling that subservience. That subservience that the land, especially the land of Israel, where of all places, you're in the palace of the king, of all places to bow to idols, right? The greatest chutzpah in the world is right in the presence of the king to go and bow to idols, to channel your energies elsewhere, right? So they got to be destroyed, right? Or chased out of the land, right? Then the Jews take a land, but the goyim themselves could bring sacrifices, right? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, you know that he had a chavrusa. Who was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's chavrusa? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the compiler of the Mishnah, had a very famous chavrusa. You know who chavrusa was? Some Roman guy. You know who that Roman guy was? Marcus Aurelius. Did you ever hear of Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor? Right? The Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius had a chavrusa with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the Gemara says. Gemara Avodah Zarah says that that Marcus Aurelius used to have a tunnel leading from his palace, apparently in Caesarea, how do you pronounce it? Right, from Caesarea? How do you pronounce it?
Caesarea.
Huh? Caesarea, right? From Caesarea leading to wherever Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was living in Tiberias, he had a secret tunnel, and he would go in and he would learn. And he had learned Torah with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And they loved each other. Right? They had a tremendous friend, they had a tremendous union, tremendous bond. And nothing wrong with going in per se. But if they're idol worshippers, right, they're rejected. But if you want to serve in the base of Migas, you want to bring a sacrifice, they could bring their sacrifice, and you accept the sacrifice from them, and you offer it in the base of Migdash. But if the sacrifice has a moon, if it has some type of imperfection, then that has to be rejected. That's the mission. Yes, Terry.
Can a Jew offer sacrifice for children to be done in his mouth?
For?
You know the way we sacrifice animals for children?
Okay, that's a good question. The only type, they're limited, there's only one type of sacrifice they can bring, so it's called a volunteer sacrifice. That means the Torah prescribes where a Jew has certain obligatory sacrifices, or what you call a tshuva sacrifice, right? Where you did an avera and you got to bring a korban as tshuva. The non-Jew, it could be that that's his intention, right? But he has no sacrifice which is an obligation for him. And if he specifically brings it for that purpose, then it's not accepted. He can only bring what's called a neder. What's a neder in Hebrew? A promise, an oath, or a nedava. A nedava is a donation. Those are the sacrifices the non-Jew can bring, right? But the point is that he is not limited to bringing a sacrifice to the base of Migdash. 293 is that a korban has to be at least 8 days old. That means that the korban, you are not allowed to bring a sacrifice of an animal which is less than 8 days old. The animal has got to have had at least 8 days of life. Now, the basic idea, and a little slightly deeper idea. The basic idea is what? What do you think the basic? Why was it
circumcision?
8 days. Now we're talking about an animal. Yeah. Right? It's an animal, no circumcision, right? So why would it need 8 days?
Isn't it to make sure to take a baby away from its mother?
Okay, well, we're going to see that in a second. That's by the birds, by the mother birds, right? We're going to see about that in a second. One of the basic ideas is there is that certain human element, right? Let the mother have the baby for, you know, at least a week. Right?
See the showers?
I'm sorry? There is a mystical idea. I don't know what it is. I once saw it in a book and I don't understand it. There's something about the animal being alive for one showers. Right? I think, that might be a mistake. I think that was why circumcision is on the eighth day.
Okay.
Right? I think that's why circumcision is on the eighth day. It might not be that by sacrifice. Some idea about having to live, be alive at least for one Shabbos before the circumcision takes place. Here, the basic idea is, I mean, anybody who's been around animals, right? An animal for the first 7 days of life is really scrawny and weakly, right, and not very aesthetically attractive, right? There's got to be a certain point, right? You could argue, well, I may argue it's not attractive until 2 weeks of life, right? There's a certain point where the Torah says it's so weak and scrawny, it's not suitable to be brought into the base of English. It's an insult to bring such a sacrifice, right? Therefore, you have to wait until the eighth day. Okay, that's idea number one. Right, that's the most basic idea. The other idea is that the same way that this is the Kli Yakar, it's one of the classic commentaries in Chumash. The average Chumash, almost every standard Chumash has a Kli Yakar commentary, and he was Baal Tshuva. Kli Yakar was Baal Tshuva, right? He made it into the Chumash. The sky's the limit, right? The Kli Yakar says that the same way that the number eight is that dimension that transcends nature, right? That non-physical dimension of existence, right? That means that the world is 7 days, the world is contained in seven. God created the world in seven, number eight, that number that transcends nature. So the animal is only fitting for the holiness of being a sacrifice once it's been alive for 8 days. That means for the first 7 days, you'd say it's bound to the physical world. And the first 7 days is under the influence of the physical, so to speak, right? And physicality versus spirituality, which one is more holy? Obviously spirituality. Therefore, you need the animal on the eighth day. Once it hits the eighth day, then you can do the sacrifice in the basin. That's what the Kli Yakar says. Okay, so that's 293. Now, 294 is Joshua, this is what you were getting at. 294 is that it's a sort of an offshoot. For regular consumption, for regular meat consumption, you are not allowed to slaughter a mother and child on the same day. You're not allowed to slaughter a mother animal and a child animal on the same day. Now, the Sefer HaMitzvah says the basic rationale for it is probably something that's intuitive, right? What would you say the reason is?
Because I can sense that the other one is being sacrificed.
The truth is that I think that there are laws of not sacrificing. They would take the dead chickens when they were sacrificing the chickens around Yom Kippur time. They took the shechted chicken, and the chickens are all in a bunch of cages and are waiting to be shechted. And somebody took a dead chicken. I don't remember where it was. I just remember they took a dead chicken and put it on the cage where the other chickens were. And somebody started yelling, "It's Tsar Balei Chayim." That means you're causing pain to the living creatures because they sense that their companion is dead, right? And that's our lifetime. I think that you're not allowed to do it within close proximity of each other. There are some halachas like that in order to stop the cruelty to the animals. The basic idea is that there's some type of gross insensitivity here, right? Somebody who can sacrifice a mother and her child on the same day is a basic insensitivity. And the Torah says, for some reason we intuitively understand that that's improper, right? Now, one of the commentaries says it has something to do with, it symbolizes wiping out the entire species. Right, that you're destroying the entire species, which we're not supposed to do. That means that there's certain consideration. The fact that you can sacrifice it the next day, it's a symbolic idea, right? Because you're not really destroying the entire species, right? But symbolically, to go and just sacrifice the whole family, right? There's some type of idea there of improper that is an act of cruelty, right? So that's the problem.
It's like in the Holocaust, the way they did. I mean, the whole families.
Well, that was human beings.
Yeah,
and
I'm saying, but
it's some type of cruelty. That's what the commentary talk about, some type of cruelty that you're doing on the same day. They even say that for sending off the mother bird. Right? That if you take the eggs and the mother bird at the same time, there's some type of a breeze. It means that when we talk about the insensitivity is not necessarily on the particular act, but an accumulation of actions breeds insensitivity inside us. So if we're insensitive here a little bit, an insensitive here, an insensitive here, eventually we are turning ourselves into insensitive people. Like sending away the mother bird, one of the ideas is that if you send away the mother bird, if you take the entire nest, the mother bird and the eggs and everything, what you're demonstrating is you don't care about anybody else. You're taking it all for yourself. Right? Where the halakha requires take the egg, send the mother bird away.
So, like, is that saying that species becoming extinct is, it's we're not allowed to do it, so it's not part of the natural process of things?
What, species becoming extinct?
Yeah. We're not allowed to do it because it's like we're, you know,
we're not supposed species. To, we don't have to worry about that. Right? People always ask about species becoming extinct. We don't have to worry about that, right? About preserving species. That's not our job, right? If this is the last cow in the world, right, and I'm hungry, I can sacrifice it. I can shuck the cow and I can eat it. I don't have to worry about, oh yeah, but what are we gonna do about more cows, right? We don't, on the other hand, we're not allowed to do something symbolically that demonstrates the wiping them out, not leaving for other people. But I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about species becoming extinct. And that's why people ask about what happened to the dinosaurs, right? They obviously weren't chefed, I don't know if they're kosher, right? People ask, what happened to the dinosaurs, right? Depending on what you want, maybe, what's the bird called? Pterodactyl? Hey, right? The pterodactyl, I think I saw that on, something like that. The bird might have been kosher if there was a pterodactyl, right? Assuming there was, right? Assuming there was, it might have been kosher, right? I don't know. They didn't say the Torah is not one of the species that's mentioned in the Torah. But when people ask, what happened to the dinosaurs, right? Well, what happened to the American bisons, right? Yeah, they became extinct, right? You know, ancient cavemen may have wiped them out, right? And when they had their dinosaur hunting contests, like just like buffaloes or whatever. So it's those steer at the Torah. The fact that dinosaurs aren't around, they could have gone extinct. It's not a threat of any sort. If there were dinosaurs to begin with, for you, Richard. That'd be 290, better go on before we have an act of cruelty. 295, 296, we actually spoke about during the summer program. 295 is the prohibition of making a chil Hashem. Making a chil Hashem, a desecration of God's name. Right now, in the Torah, where the Torah speaks about chil Hashem, the most fundamental type is where a person is expected to give up his life, and he doesn't. Like, under the circumstances where a Jew is threatened and is told that if you don't do this avera, I'm going to kill you, under certain circumstances the Jew has to allow himself to be killed. Incidentally, this is a response. The response to people who always talk about how life is, you know, the famous question about saving certain lives on Shabbos, right? You know, why are you allowed to save a Jew's life on Shabbos? Why can you save a Jew's life on Shabbos by desecrating Shabbos? Because they'll keep more Shabbos. What does that tell you? That means on a scale of value, which is more important? Shabbos is more important. When people say to you, yeah, but isn't life the most important thing? The answer is absolutely not. Right? We find all over the Torah, life is not. Life is, like we are willing to give up our lives, or should be willing, right, in order for certain avers not to be done. A chil Hashem is, if a Jew, under certain circumstances, has to give up his life, and refuses to give up his life, that's a chil Hashem. That's a desecration of God's name. Now, that's at the level that nobody should have to face that test, right? We do not want that test, because we don't know how we're going to respond. We daven every morning, we say, please do not put us in a circuit in conditions of test. That's the first type of chil Hashem. Next type of chil Hashem is anybody at a subjective level doing anything that will cause people to think negatively of Torah. Right? That means if a yeshiva student does something, right, and this is always the big test, when somebody sees a Torah person doing something, and he says, if that's the way a Torah person behaves, right, that's a chil Hashem. Right? When somebody sees somebody doing something, which is a bad name, it brings a bad name for God and a bad name for Torah, that is at everybody's subjective level, it's a chil Hashem. Depending on where you're holding, depending on what's expected of you, it could be a chil Hashem. That's why the Gemara talks about, the one example. Rabbi Yochanan says that if anybody ever sees me walking 4 amos without being wrapped in talis and tefillin, without, Rabbi Yochanan said, if I walk 4 amos and I don't have tefillin on, and my lips aren't moving, I'm not speaking Torah, that's a chil Hashem. For Rabbi Yochanan at his level, he was expected every minute of every day to always be completely immersed in Torah. And if anybody sees, Rabbi Yochanan said about himself, if anybody were to see me not study for a couple of seconds, That's the Chil Hashem. If anybody saw me, ever saw me without tefillin, that's the Chil Hashem. Because the Chil Hashem is subjective to your level. I tell you, when I was in Kolol, our Rosh Kolol told us that we should think twice before sitting on the buses. Right? Because even if, you know, if an older person gets on the bus, you stand up. Right? When an older person gets on, you stand up and give up your seat. What about a younger person? Well, you don't have to get up and give your seat to a younger person. But the nature of people is that when you get on the bus, and you look around the bus, and there's a guy with a black hat is sitting there in a seat, and you're not, there's a certain resentment, right? Why, you know, why is he sitting? And he should know, somebody should be sitting, anybody but him, right? And you have a responsibility to try to not bring, as the firmer you get, right, for lack of a better term, right? The firmer you get, certainly externally, the more responsibility you carry. Right. That's why I just saw so many people always ask if I'm going to go into I'm going to do an Avera. Right. I'm going to go into a non-kosher restaurant. Should I take off my yarmulke or not? Right. Should you take off your yarmulke before going in? Because on the one hand, why do another Avera? On the other hand, if you keep your yarmulke on, it's going to give me a Chil Hashem. So I saw last night, I was looking at Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, had somebody ask him a question. There's going to be a communal function. And at this communal function, there's going to be mixed dancing. And among the people who are involved in mixed dancing are going to be frum people who wear yarmulkes. I didn't say what level frum, right? Just as Torah observant Jews, Shomer Shabbos Jews wearing yarmulkes. Should they keep their take off their yarmulkes? They're going to do the Avera. Should they take off their yarmulkes or not take off their yarmulkes? That's what they answer. That's what they answer Moshe. So Moshe said no. He says, the fact that you're going to do one Avera doesn't justify going ahead and doing another Avera. And then he goes into the whole long thing about how doing the mitzvah, doing it, it can come in two directions. On the one hand, right, well, I don't want to make a Chil Hashem by not wearing my yarmulke. On the other hand, if you realize that wearing your yarmulke will be a Chil Hashem, maybe you won't do the Avera.
Right, but it's also been the same as someone that wrote to him and said, saying, I'm going to McDonald's for a cheeseburger.
Yeah, there's no difference between eating a cheeseburger and dancing with a woman who's not your wife, right? I mean, dancing with a woman who, even if it is your wife, in public is also not acceptable. But to touch another woman, yeah, there's a difference between them, right? You don't have to give up your life for eating a cheeseburger. You would have to give up your life not to touch a woman that's improper for you to touch.
You would.
That's exactly what I said. Right? And do you know that there are halachic authorities who say, that if a woman sticks out her hand to you, to shake hands, it's Yehari Gal Yavur. Yehari Gal Yavur means you must die rather than transgress. Right? Because any of the, I'm going to say some people have died 1,000 lives, right? 1,000 lives. Any time, right? It gets worse, don't worry, it gets worse before it gets better. Any one of the big three Averas, idol worship, immorality, or murder, anytime you have to not commit the Avera, you have to give up your life, doesn't just mean the thing itself. It means the thing itself, plus what the Hebrew word is, kol abizrayu. Abizrayu means all of the side dishes, right? That means that everything that goes with it, right? Are you allowed to worship idols? No. Are you allowed to go up and wash an idol? Right? And Andrew says you go hug that idol. Right? Not worship, you're just hugging it. Anything that isn't even related to idol worship, you've got to give up your life for it. Right? Anything related to morality, you have to give up your life for it. Now don't quote me. Please do not quote me. Kaplan said, I can't shake your hand, I got to die rather than next time you shake your hand. Right? You embarrass the person. So that's what everybody talks about, you embarrass the person. On the other hand, the same person who you're embarrassing, right? If you go to their house, they were to put out, you're sitting with guests at the table, right? And they didn't know you became a religious fanatic, right? And you came to the house, they invited you over, and you're sitting there in a room full of people, and they put out non-kosher food in front of you, right? Now, if you reject the food, you're going to embarrass them. Does that mean you should eat the food to save them embarrassment? Obviously not. So to shake the woman's hand is no different. And I've always heard it quoted that you're allowed to do it in order to save. This thing about embarrassing, I remember when I was in youth group growing up, that was one of the things that everybody everybody always knew. That halakha everybody knew. Oh, we don't want to embarrass anybody. Yes, what do you got your arm around her for? Right? Embarrassing her, shaking her. What's one thing, you know, what's that got to do with? Yeah. All of a sudden, we don't want to embarrass her, and I want to make sure not to embarrass her. Right? And, you know, all of a sudden, everybody becomes big tzaddikim when it comes to this mitzvah. Right? So the halakha is that, and I've never seen it in print, that you're allowed to, and I've seen several places that you're not allowed to. And the Stipler in his classic manner, Stipler says, everybody's worried about this lady who's sticking out her hand. Nobody's worried about the Torah being trampled on. That nobody cares about. Only this lady. That everybody's so worried about. Right? That means that if all of a sudden we're very sensitive. Now let me tell you something. There are two types of people who will stick out their hands to you to shake your hand. Right? It may be somebody who's totally ignorant and has absolutely no idea. In which case, you tell them the first time, you say to them, look, I can't shake hands with women. I don't shake hands with women. They're looking at you like you are a fanatic anyway. Right? So another one of your fanatical ideas, right? They're not going to hassle you. Right? There's something you just don't shake hands with women. There are other people who are testing you. Right? Some people who are, you know, maybe not as firm as you and resent the fact that you are putting yourself up to be so religious. And quite frankly, those people deserve to be embarrassed, right? Because what they're doing is they're trying to ridicule your Torah observance. So somebody who is looking to laugh at Torah and says, ha ha, how you doing for me? Right? You know, I would spit. Right? Well, what are you doing? You're laughing at Torah? Right? You deserve to be embarrassed. I'm not going to intentionally embarrass her. On the other hand, I'm not going to shave her hand.
Please turn the tape to the other side.